Today at Reader's Corner, Mark Clifford, author of The Troublemaker, How Jimmy Lee Became a Billionaire, Hong Kong's Greatest Dissident, and China's Most Feared Critic. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his latest book, The Troublemaker, Mark Clifford offers an intimate biography of the billionaire businessman Jimmy Lee, a leading Hong Kong democracy activist fighting for freedom of speech, who also became China's most famous political prisoner. Mark Clifford is president of the Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong Foundation, dedicated to democracy, human rights, and the rule of law for the people of Hong Kong. He is the author of Today Hong Kong, Tomorrow the World, and he holds a PhD in Hong Kong history from the University of Hong Kong. Mark Clifford, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, great to be here, Bob.
Mark, let's start with the present, and then we'll go back and cover some of Jimmy's bio. Where is he right now? How old is he? What kind of health is he in?
Yeah, all good questions and all a little bit difficult to answer. He's been shuttling between two prisons in Hong Kong. He's on trial on national security law charges, even though he's already been in jail for over 4 years, mostly in solitary confinement, mostly in the maximum security Stanley Prison, built in the 1930s during the British colonial period. His health, well, he was diabetic going into prison. 4+ years in solitary confinement has not improved his health. He's in his late 70s. We think he's 77. He was born in a time of great chaos in China. So nobody seems to be sure exactly what year he was born, but 1947 or 48. So he's diabetic. He's had COVID in prison. He had botched cataract surgery in prison. He was a child laborer, so he lost his hearing as a teenager. So he's not in great shape. And solitary confinement is rough on anybody. That's why the United Nations considers it something that should only be used as a last resort and is considered torture if it goes on for more than 15 days. So in Jimmy's case, it's more than 1,500 days. So not a great situation. And yet he keeps fighting. Jimmy Lai is a man of great principle. And I think that makes it hard for the Chinese communists to know quite what to do with him.
You know, when I think of Jimmy after reading your book, I think of the Russian Alexei Navalny. In fact, I'm looking at his book right now in my library, Patriot, a memoir. I don't have anybody to interview on that one for obvious reasons. The Russians killed him. I wonder, what's the difference between what Jimmy's going through and how the Chinese authorities look at him and allow him to stay alive? Does he takes visitors, doesn't he? Doesn't he get to see his family?
He gets to see his wife twice a month, gets to see his lawyers. So, I mean, actually, it's a great question. And I think Navalny and well-known political prisoners, Mandela, some of the Soviet refuseniks. I mean, we have to put Jimmy in that kind of category. Big difference. He never wanted political power. Navalny actually wanted to take power in Russia, and that's one reason Putin had him killed. Jimmy was a businessman who got into politics almost by accident. He was in the garment trade, and he was so moved and eventually horrified by what happened in the June 4th, 1989 killings when hundreds, maybe thousands of Chinese were killed by their own government, that he decided to go into media. And he thought that transparency would be a way of, shining a spotlight on the Chinese Communist Party and hastening its demise. He is in Hong Kong. So Hong Kong, as I alluded to before, was a British colony for 156 years. It only went back to Chinese rule in 1997. And as part of its promises to the British before it took Hong Kong back, China promised a lot of good things, basically a continuation of British freedoms. Now, it's broken most of those promises, but it does still have open courts. So Jimmy has been on trial for over 140 days of court cases. He himself was on the stand for more than 50 days. So we can see him. We couldn't. We Navalny didn't get that. Most political prisoners in China proper in the mainland, it's done, dusted. It's an hour or two in a closed court. Jimmy has had the advantage of an open court where his family, where press, where diplomats are able to see, and he's giving as good as he's getting. I mean, honestly, I have to say, we're about to the closing argument stage, and it doesn't seem that the government has proven a thing. They will still find him guilty, of course, but
Right.
it's we see what a charade this whole
Yeah.
process is.
So if he is convicted, do we know just what will happen then? Will he still have the kind of access to family, for example, or is he hidden away in some Chinese prison we never even heard of?
Yeah, great question. So far, they have kept Hong Kong prisoners in Hong Kong. They've changed laws recently, which theoretically would make it possible to move Jimmy to the mainland. Honestly speaking, I feel like he's a kind of a hot potato that the Chinese mainlanders don't really want. They kind of would rather have the Hong Kongers deal with it. So if that continues, he should still be able to see his wife two, three, maybe four times a month. It's behind plexiglass. It's 20 or 30 minutes. It's not
Yeah,
nice.
right.
He's a devout Catholic. He hasn't been able to take communion in 2 years. I mean, it's really quite cruel what they're doing to him.
Well, his is certainly a Horatio Alger rags to riches story. Tell us about those humble beginnings. I guess he was a victim of the Great Leap Forward, among other things.
Yeah, well, he was born, as I said, we're not really sure, a year or two before Mao took power in 1949. So he was born in the late 1940s into a wealthy family. His mother was actually the second wife. She was kind of almost like a concubine to take care of the first wife's children and basically be mother number two, as Jimmy always had to call her. The father hightailed it off to Hong Kong after the communists took power. And the mother, although she'd been a peasant because she married into this rich family, the family was just destroyed. She was sent to labor camp type work camp situations. She was forced to kneel on ground glass, wear a dunce's cap, be humiliated by people simply because she married into a rich family. Jimmy's a primary school dropout. He was hustling. He was on the streets from the age of six or so. I mean, cadging, half smoked cigarettes and re-rolling the tobacco into selling that, and carrying bags at a train station. Anyway, he managed to steal away, smuggle himself into Hong Kong, which was nearby. He grew up in southern China. Smuggled himself in on a fishing boat and became one of hundreds of thousands. Actually, there were about 1.5 million refugees at that point. He was one of those. He was sleeping in a factory. 15 years later, he owned a factory. I mean, he was a child laborer who just really made it good. And he was selling to companies like The Limited, Polo, big US companies. I mean, he really, before I've known Jimmy since 1993, so over 3 decades. Until I was writing this biography, and I never, of course, intended to write a biography, but I felt I needed to do something once he went to prison. I had no idea what an extraordinary businessman he was. I thought he was one of thousands and thousands of Hong Kongers who'd ridden the wave of export-oriented prosperity. And what I found is he was one of the absolute best entrepreneurs of his age in Hong Kong. And first he was making sweaters, then he's made the biggest sweater manufacturer in Hong Kong, if not in Asia, 20 years after he arrives as a penniless kid. Then he gets bored with making sweaters, decides he'll start selling sweaters and shirts. He sets up what became kind of the father of fast fashion. I'm sure many of your readers have heard of Uniqlo, the Japanese retailer. Well, the head of Uniqlo, Tadashi Inai, came down to learn from Jimmy and offered to have Jimmy invest in the store. Jimmy decided not to. And then he went from the rag trade into media after the Tiananmen killing. So it's just one success after another. The guy is just a brilliant, visionary, farsighted entrepreneur. And the fact that Hong Kong and China need to put a guy like this behind bars, a guy who's created thousands and thousands of jobs, untold wealth for people, the fact that he's, wasting his energy, and well, I don't know if he's wasting it, but anyway, he's in prison right now when he could be contributing to society as an entrepreneur or as a leader.
So I think I remember reading in your bio that you lived in Hong Kong for many years. How'd you meet Jimmy?
So I was a journalist. I'm a recovering journalist, and I moved there in 1992. So the waning years of British colonial rule, and just he was one of the entrepreneurs. He'd started this Giordano, the clothing company that I mentioned, the retail company, and had just taken it public. And a friend of mine, another journalist who'd met him a year or so earlier, said I should go meet him. He was already kind of well known, not just because he was really successful as a businessman, but because he was one of the most outspoken business people about the student democracy movement in 1989 in China. He supported that, sold T-shirts, and sent the money up to the kids in Tiananmen, and was unwavering in his support for democracy. And so just sounded like an interesting guy, and Hong Kong's the kind of place where you can go meet anybody. And I went over to his house, and he cooked me lunch, which was pretty nice because sometimes you might have a lunch with a CEO, but he's the first and last that ever cooked the lunch for me. So
right.
just started a nice friendship. And I went onto the board of directors of the media company in 2018. So I mean, I'd known him for quite a while before I did that.
So Jimmy's political beliefs are very interesting. I mean, it's not like this is your typical liberal who is fighting autocratic rule. He's fighting autocratic rule, but from a slightly different political perspective. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that would be an understatement. He's a radical free marketeer, almost verging on libertarian. He spent a lot of time in New York when he was making sweaters, selling sweaters, and he knew a lot of people. He was a very gregarious, very engaging guy, and I think like many self-taught people, as I said, he was a primary school dropout. I'm not even sure he got to fifth grade. Repeated a few years. Was really driven to read a lot and to educate himself. And somebody after a dinner one night, he was railing on about how horrible the communist Chinese were. The guy, his host, reached into the bookshelf and said, basically learn something, get a little more theory and a little more background. And he gave him Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom, which was really about how state planning inevitably leads to totalitarianism. And he started reading the great liberal in the kind of classic 19th century sense, liberal thinkers like Hayek, Popper. Eventually, strangely, met and became very good friends with Milton Friedman, the radical free market economist. Friedman writes about him in his memoirs. He skews libertarian and very, very free market on the economic side, which made sense in the Hong Kong that he came out of. But skews pretty right on the political side too. I mean, he supported Trump in 2016, thinking that he was like many business people, thinking that a business guy will be kind of good for America and deregulation, economic growth. So yeah, he's not your garden variety kind of left liberal lawyer, human rights activist at all.
Today, I'm speaking with Mark Clifford, author of The Troublemaker. The book is a comprehensive biography of billionaire businessman Jimmy Lee, a leading Hong Kong democracy activist who became China's most famous political prisoner. So he got into the media business. You alluded to that a little earlier. At one point, someone on his board compared him to Joseph Pulitzer. But tell us about Apple Daily. And, well, I guess his first venture was the magazine called Next.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting. He had zero media background. And after Tiananmen and the killings in 1989, we just forget how much the world's changed, Bob, since we were younger. I mean, it's not even a half a century ago, there was, of course, no internet. CNN, if we can take ourselves back to those years, CNN was a new force. The idea that you could broadcast pretty much real-time events using satellite uplinks of an uprising in Tiananmen Square was new. And I mean, Jimmy was really taken by that technology. And again, he felt that the transparency that the new technology brought would, allow him with media to shine a spotlight on the misdoings and the mistakes of the Chinese Communist Party and enable its, hasten its demise. But he was a businessman. He first and foremost went into media as a business. In fact, talked about starting and then selling the magazine. Who wants to run a magazine in so much trouble? But he had a magazine that had the best investigative teams that Hong Kong had ever seen. Hong Kong's a small city, 7.5 million people, but you know, it's a really lively media market. It had paparazzi pictures. He put his photographers on motorcycles so they could beat the police or the firemen to the scene of a crime. I mean, he had stock market stuff. He had basically a very, very strong pro-democracy bias, but it was everything. It was horse racing, it was scandal, it was sex, it was crime, you know, it was economics. And he bundled it all into one magazine and you know, very quickly had a real hit. And then he started the newspaper 5 years later in 1995. Very brave, 2 years before the Chinese communists are going to take over. All the other media people are pulling back, you know, trimming their coverage, their criticism of China. Not Jimmy. He said, I've got a market. Most Hong Kong people always vote for pro-democracy candidates. In fact, historically, close to 6 out of 10 in every single free election have always voted for pro-democracy candidates. So I got a market and I got no competition because all my competitors are afraid. So he plunged ahead and you know, it wasn't, you know, it was often a salacious, you know, newspaper that took things to the edge of good taste, sometimes beyond, you know, as years went by. That you know, he pulled back some of the excesses and pushed forward with a pro-democracy agenda. So, in the absence of strong political parties in Hong Kong, Jimmy and his team at Next and Apple became almost the kind of de facto organizing instrument and almost like an opposition political party.
I'm just curious. So, what's it like today in Hong Kong? Where do people go for news and how good is it?
Well, I left about 4 years ago, just before Jimmy was put behind bars, and a lot of my six other colleagues as well. So I can't tell you from firsthand experience, but I can tell you I follow it very closely, of course, as president of the Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong Foundation. It's bad. There are almost 2,000 people who have been convicted and jailed on political offenses. There's no such thing as a free press. People are thrown in jail because government doesn't like a t-shirt they're wearing, or they don't look respectful when the national anthem is played. I mean, it's a pretty Orwellian place. There's not a lot of news. I mean, there's some kind of no comment, straight ahead news, but anything investigative, anything serious, no way. And I mean, many journalists have been jailed. It's not just Jimmy and our six other colleagues at Apple Daily, but you know, quite a few other publications have either shut down and other people have gotten the message. You know, dozens, if not scores or hundreds of journalists have left Hong Kong, gone to the UK or Australia or Canada.
So when and how did Jimmy make the leap to Taiwan?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. So he started Next Magazine in 1990, a year after the Tiananmen killings in Hong Kong, started the newspaper in 95. And as you might get a sense, he's a restless serial entrepreneur, you know, making sweaters and selling sweaters and starting a magazine, a newspaper. And in Taiwan, in March 2000, the first ever opposition presidential candidate actually won. He ended a 50-plus year monopoly by the ruling Nationalist Party, the KMT. And Jimmy said to his wife that night, "We're moving to Taiwan." He thought that was the future of democracy in China. In some senses, I think he's right. He was a little bit premature. And he did the same thing, repeated his formula in Taiwan. And not a lot of business people are particularly successful in moving abroad, and yet he did it. First, he started Next Magazine. 2 years later, he starts Apple Daily Taiwan. Again, really shook up the media. I think he was too optimistic because he thought that the example of democracy in Taiwan would spill over to the mainland, that he could use Taiwan as a springboard for Apple.
Well, his personal life is certainly intertwined with his professional life, and his second wife seems to be the reason why he converts to Catholicism. You mentioned his Catholicism earlier. What I think is so interesting about Jimmy in prison is the emphasis that you explain in your book about Jimmy remaining a free person for the rest of his life, almost like a monk's life. This is a guy who says he's free in prison, and it all seems to revolve around his religion, among other things.
Yeah, no, I think thanks for picking up on that. It was his wife, who Teresa, who shared that with me, and I was lucky enough to have access to some of the writing that he did the first couple of years he was in prison. He is not in prison because of his religious beliefs, but his religious beliefs have strengthened his resolve and allow him to not only survive, but I mean, I think, as you say, to thrive in prison. Of course, he'd rather be out. He wants to be out. He wants to leave Hong Kong. He's a British citizen. He wants to, be able to spend his last years with his family. But while he's in prison, he's making the most of it. And I think your analogy to a monk is a good one, but a specific kind of monk. His godfather, Bill McGurn, describes it as the life of a Benedictine monk. It's not like he's some wild-eyed prophet out in the desert or something. He's got a very strict, very regularized routine. He doesn't have a clock. He doesn't have a window. I mean, he's in rough conditions. He doesn't get to decide when he eats or, of course, what he eats. But within that, he has to do forced prison labor. He makes envelopes. He gets paid about one cent an envelope. But he does a lot of drawing. To my surprise, I also learned this during the biography. He studied with a renowned, it was very good friends with a renowned Chinese American artist, Wallace Ting. And Wallace Ting did a variety of, I guess you could say, quite secular subjects: women, cats, flowers. For Jimmy, it's the Virgin Mary and Christ on the cross. It is very, very religious art, and he's done hundreds of them. Doesn't have any pen paints or anything. It's all pencil, colored pencil. And he reads the Bible, and he prays, and he reads a huge amount of theology. He gets a couple of books a month. Usually reads in English. I think sometimes he reads in French. It's all Catholic theology. I mean, from Thomas Aquinas to Pope Benedict. I think he draws the line at Pope Francis, but that's a personal choice of his.
Can any of Jimmy's children succeed him and be the voice for freedom in China and Hong Kong?
Well, his son Sebastian lives in Taiwan now. Sebastian's also a British citizen. He's emerged as a spokesperson for the calling for his father's release, but he's much more focused on his father's release. I think it's pretty hard to follow in Jimmy's footsteps. And he had a unique platform in the media platform, and that's gone. I mean, the company was stolen from us. It was summarily shut down without a court order. Assets were frozen, stripped, sold off. That media platform doesn't exist anymore. So it would be hard to see them taking that kind of political leadership role. I think it's really just a family thing of, Sebastian and some of the other kids doing what they can to free their father. And I think that the cruelty of the Hong Kong government in threatening Sebastian simply for speaking out in favor of his father is just it's just unspeakable. I think it's yet a demonstration of the cruelty of the Chinese communist regime.
When you look at Jimmy Lee and his career, how does it contrast with Rupert Murdoch, another media emperor?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Jimmy is a great entrepreneur. He doesn't have the same kind of stick-to-itiveness that I think Murdoch or Tadashi Yanai of Uniqlo had. I mean, he kind of flits from one idea to the next. So he's a great entrepreneur. He's not an empire builder in the same sense as a Murdoch or a Tadashi Yanai from Uniqlo would be. On the other hand, he has principles that if Murdoch has them, they're a little less evident than with Jimmy. I mean, Murdoch claimed, he kowtowed to the Chinese. First, he talked about satellite TV, which he owned, one of the early satellite broadcasters in Asia. Talked about that as being an unambiguous threat to totalitarian regimes everywhere. The Chinese took that seriously and shut down access to his programming in China. And he, crawled on his knees, kowtowed to them for years, eventually, gave up on China. Murdoch seems to be driven by a fascination with power and being a power behind the scenes in a way that Jimmy isn't. I mean, again, what's remarkable about Jimmy is he actually, unlike a Mandela or a behind the scenes guy like Murdoch, he seems to actually have no desire for political power. He just seems to believe that people should be free, economies should be free, and that, freedom is a fundamental right that everybody should have, and they should, have the right to write what they want, say what they want, speak what they want. I mean, he's kind of a, as they say, almost a libertarian without any personal ambitions. He's not really driven by money. As I say, he's not driven by power. So he's really, I think, quite unusual as a political prisoner and as a media, as a powerful media person.
It's interesting that you bring up this issue of Jimmy deciding to stay in Hong Kong. When Navalny was poisoned, of course, he was cured. They dealt with that in Germany. And then he made the decision to come back, which was a deadly decision, and a decision that I have to figure he could have figured out on his own. I mean, it was just going to happen. In Jimmy's case, this is a guy who says, yeah, I'm staying too. This is where I belong. This is my country, my land. But again, if he had left, he would today be speaking out way more publicly than he can speak out from a Hong Kong prison. So in a sense, we kind of pay for his decision. I know it's an honorable one, but again, from the Navalny experience, we see all we have now left is a book, and we don't have the person.
Yeah, but in both cases, I think we have an example of a person who is courageous almost beyond human belief or endurance. And right. I think if Navalny had left, yeah, maybe he would have been speaking out, but he would have been impotent. And I think that's the same thing with Jimmy. Would anybody be listening? I mean, the world is looking at Jimmy because he has put his life on the line. I think if he were out, would have been on talk shows for a few weeks or something, but like, so what? So you're another rich guy from Hong Kong who left. Yeah. What kind of moral authority does that give you? And I think Jimmy felt that this is what he believed in, and he needed to stand firm for his principles. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a letter that Richard Nixon wrote Deng Xiaoping back in March 1990. So again, we're going back to the Tiananmen period. Relations between the U.S. and China were very rocky. And a well-known Chinese physicist, Fang Lezhi, had found, and who's a great human rights advocate as well, had found sanctuary in the U.S. embassy. He'd already been there for 9 months. And Nixon was trying to persuade Deng to let him go, to give him safe passage to come to the U.S. And in the end, he did get out, but he was in for more than a year. Really quite tough. And Nixon wrote Deng. He said, you know, look, we're different. You're communist. I'm capitalist. I'm not going to try to convert you. But look, these guys, you let them out. These human rights people, you let them out. They're on the talk shows for a couple of weeks. They disappear.
You point out that life in Hong Kong is pretty tough when some of the sources you went to just wouldn't go on the record, just couldn't cooperate with you. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, Bob. I mean, it's worse than that. There were people I talked to who were at, let's just say, big U.S. companies who knew him 30 years ago who said, please don't put my name in the acknowledgments. There were lots and lots of people I did talk to who just said, I don't even want to be in the acknowledgments. I don't want anybody to know that I know you or I know Jimmy Lai. The amount of fear that China has engendered in people is it's unbelievable. And I run across it in my work all the time. People realize that when you're dealing with China, you're dealing with, almost like a mafia kind of state. And it just doesn't forget. And if you're an academic, it's going to deny you a visa. If you're an ordinary tourist, well, you just don't know what's going to happen. So everybody kind of makes their own adjustments, does their self-censorship. And I really was, I interviewed, I did over 100 interviews for the book. I talked to plenty of people, but I really was struck by the amount of fear that China's engendered, even among people living in the West.
So just curious, Mark, is there any chance for a prisoner exchange? This has happened in Russia a few times. I'm not so sure I've seen it happen in China as often. Tell us about that.
Well, thanks. Jimmy is going to be convicted without a doubt, and it's effectively a life sentence. He's in his late 70s. It'll be a minimum 10-year sentence, could be life. So there's got to be a political deal. And President Trump during the campaign said he would 100% get Jimmy Lai out. And I think that's going to take a mano-a-mano negotiation with Xi Jinping. And I would hope that the Chinese and the U.S. and Jimmy's a British citizen, so that they could come to some kind of agreement. China has moved more towards prisoner swaps in the last couple of years, did that with a couple of Canadians that it took as hostage. In the waning months of the Biden administration, there were some wrongfully detained Americans who came back. So it could happen. But it's dependent on broader Sino-U.S. relations, and those have to be good. I think it would likely happen around a summit between General Secretary Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump. So Let's wait. The prospects for that don't look particularly promising at the moment, but let's see what happens.
The book is The Troublemaker, How Jimmy Lee Became a Billionaire, Hong Kong's Greatest Dissident, and China's Most Feared Critic. The author, Mark Clifford, who we've been listening to this last half hour. Mark, I want to thank you for writing the book. First of all, this has been very enlightening and unfortunate for Jimmy, of course, but good to know there are people still fighting for freedom in Hong Kong. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. You're a careful and good reader. Loved your questions, so thanks a lot.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.